Hello, and thank you for joining the Institute for Historical Studies in the Department of History at the University of Texas at Austin. We are pleased that you are with us today for our podcast that highlights a new paper written by postdoctoral fellow Dr. Madeline McMahon, entitled Against the Grain, Textile Relics and the Science of Sanctity in the Global Renaissance. For most individuals, the Counter-Reformation sought to quash new forms of democratic spiritual participation in the form of Lutheranism and Calvinism. The so-called Galileo affair epitomizes this narrative of the Counter-Reformation as retrograde and even villainous. In the popular imagination, Galileo stands as the victim of the Counter-Reformation's stifling prosecution of skepticism, experimentation, and modernity. Yet Dr. Madeline McMahon begs to differ. In her manuscript, The Catholic Creation of Early Modern Knowledge, Dr. McMahon argues that by creating the institution of the resident bishop, the Counter-Reformation became the linchpin to the new confessional interventionist technocratic early modern state. In communication with other bishops and with the help of many clerics, nephews, and humanists, these Tridentine bishops sought to keep control of local parishes and parishioners via visitas and regular synods and councils. Bishops allowed for the rise of highly local forms of authority, along with doctrinal, devotional, and legal uniformity. Uniformity emerged out of two mechanisms. Bishops and their retinues of learned humanists produced compilations of bishops' rulings, regulations, and constitutions for other bishops to imitate, and secondly, bishops wrote to each other, creating thick networks of correspondence. The bishops spearheaded the modern state by the use of archives and the classifying, assembling, and printing of new legislation. They deliberately use social psychology to promote forms of local social cohesion through collective praying and rituals. These bishops were at the forefront of new forms of modern humanetics by subjecting oral and written tradition on saints and relics to exacting forms of critical analysis. Bishops hired artisans and scholars to investigate relics and saints as objects, using techniques of natural history, medical anatomy, and experimentation. Finally, as they sought to create lineages of local bishops and justify their own positions in the city-states, bishops encouraged forms of antiquarian research that would eventually give birth to modern forms of historical scholarship. While rhetorically seeking to cultivate tradition, the Counter-Reformation bishop helped create many of the institutions and practices of modernity. We are joined today by Dr. McMahon herself, who is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of History at the University of Texas at Austin. Her research focuses on intellectual, cultural, and religious history of early modern Europe. Dr. McMahon's book in progress, The Creation of Catholic Knowledge in Early Modern Italy, Bishops, Their Households, and Diocesan Work, explores the work of bishops' scientific households during the Catholic Reformation in Italy. Dr. McMahon's articles have appeared in International Journal of the Classical Tradition, the Journal of the Warburg, and Past and Present. And from UT Austin as well, we are joined by our own Dr. Jorge Canizares-Esquerra, the Alice Drysdale Sheffield Professor of History and Director of the Institute for Historical Studies. Today's podcast previews an upcoming roundtable at the Institute for Historical Studies on Dr. McMahon's paper on Monday, November 22nd from noon to 1:30 on Zoom. More details about the event, including registration information, are available on the IHS website and will be included in the show notes of this podcast. Today's podcast is also produced in collaboration with Not Even Past, a digital magazine based in the Department of History at the University of Texas at Austin that serves as a robust platform for public history with a global reach. Dr. Canizares will serve as the moderator for today's podcast, and without further ado, I am pleased to hand things over to him.
Welcome to our podcast on the Counter-Reformation, saints, demons, relics, and the new science. But before we begin our conversation on these seemingly contradictory topics, early modern Catholicism and early modern new science and the scientific revolution and their connections, let me introduce first to Ashley Garcia, whose voice you just heard. Ashley is a fifth-year graduate student in our department, the History Department at University of Texas, Austin, and she works on utopian socialism in the 19th century in the East Coast in the United States. Well, It's really a pleasure to have here Professor McMahon, Madeline or Maddie, and we'll go informal, and I'll call her Madeline, and she'll call me Jorge. And the conversation will be organized around Maddie's, Professor McMahon's revised manuscript on the Counter-Reformation bishops of Italy and the relationship to the new science. We associate Catholicism and the new science with Galileo and the opposition of the church to the new science. We, in the public imagination, we have this idea that Catholicism and the new science were at odds. Yet the work of Maddie shows that that is not really the case. Using the bishops of Italy right after the Council of Trent, or during the Council of Trent, her work is on two bishops, Paleotti and Borromeo. And so we'll ask her to give us a synthesis of what the manuscript is about, the parts of it, and the arguments. So without further ado, Maddie, tell us about the manuscript you're working on, and what is the connection between the Counter-Reformation and the new science.
Thank you so much, Jorge, and thanks for having me. Yes, so my book manuscript, pursues this question of how do we think about ecclesiastical knowledge in this period in the vein of history of science. So just to give you a couple of examples of how I got started on this path, one of the things that really struck me when I was beginning this research was that in the archiepiscopal palace of Bologna, so the bishop's household, essentially, there were all kinds of different scientific experiments being done. So, for example, the first sunflower to grow in Italy was grown by the naturalist Ulisse Aldrovandi in the garden of Gabriele Paleotti, this bishop of Bologna. And also, the Dominican mathematician and cosmographer Ignazio Danti installed a weather vane on Paleotti's roof, and also an Armilla Equinoziale in the garden as well, so to calculate the spring equinox and thus the correct date of Easter. And so all of these ways in which a bishop's household was also a scientific household were really striking to me. And as I got further into this work, I became really interested in how bishops were putting together a science of administration, especially in the aftermath of the Council of Trent. While I'm not explicitly focused on some of the things that we might think about as science today, a lot of what I talk about in terms of thinking about the authenticity of relics, which we'll be talking about today, or even gathering information on visitations and things like that, there are a lot of parallels, actually, with what was happening in scientific and other arenas of knowledge in this period.
So this is what is fascinating about this line of inquiry. You said that you were not expecting to find in the household of Paleotti evidence of this type of practices with these instruments that we associate with experimentation, the new science, Baconian science. Why it came as a surprise to you? Why you find that surprising? You have been socialized into some kind of narrative about Counter-Reformation bishops like Paleotti that made it surprising?
I guess so. As you said earlier, there's this sort of popular imagination when we think about the history of the church and science in this period. But also, what I guess I found really interesting were the ways in which other aspects of ecclesiastical knowledge making in this period were really created in parallel with other things that were happening in the sciences. So if you think just about like collecting, for instance, which we know is such an important part of Aldrovandi's practices in Bologna, for example, this also was hugely important for the amassing of relics and things like that in the same period.
Yes, but we think of birds as science. We don't think of relics as science. We don't think of collecting relics as as having anything to do with collecting. It's kind of the antithesis of collecting birds or collecting shells or collecting anything. So to think of a cathedral with lots of relics in it as a collection or as a museum, in the same vein as a Altovani's, you know, collection of fossils or what have you, it seems to be antithetical. But yet you are drawing a connection between relics and these other types of natural history collections. So how do you square the circle?
Yeah. So basically, if you look at what people are doing, you see that these, you know, borders that we have drawn are much fuzzier than we might like them to be. So if you look at, for example, just the work of Aldrovandi, he's not just, you know, working on birds and experimenting with chicken eggs. He is also writing these essentially natural histories of different relics. So one of the things that comes about from his friendship with Pagliotti is a natural history of the wood mentioned in the Bible, ultimately to kind of draw conclusions about the wood of the cross. And so, you know, you get this sense from that alongside the birds that there's like so many different facets of knowledge in this period. And so...
So Pagliotti is also, Aldrovandi is also doing history, right? So he's an antiquarian. So he's doing all sorts of things. So at the same time that he's studying these relics and these birds, he's contextualizing the wood of the cross of Christ and the Shroud of Turin within the what could be believed as a form of cultural history avant la lettre, in which these practices of wrapping linens on the body can be traced back through the Bible or through the classics using philology, Renaissance philology. So there are these elements of modernity in all these things that we associate with tradition, when in fact they seem to be creating new disciplines, including modern history.
Yeah, I think the historical and the natural sciences are really closely connected. And you see that, as you mentioned, in the work by Aldrovandi on the Shroud, where, you know, he's trying to make sense of this very mysterious object in many ways still today. And to do that, you know, what Pagliotti is really asking is, you know, is this item really possible? Because what Pagliotti ends up deciding about the Shroud, in part thanks to Aldrovandi, is that it's the natural imprint rather than a kind of miraculous imprint of Christ's dead body upon this cloth. And so in order to come to that conclusion, Aldrovandi, of course, goes through this enormous digression, right? It's like 1,400 pages about the burial practices of different cultures in the early Mediterranean world. So, yeah, I think that, you know, this kind of antiquarianism, a philological approach, a kind of like natural historical approach that you see a bit more in the manuscript on, you know, wood in the Bible, all come together in these different works, which, and I think it's no accident, you know, these are the works that he's doing in conversation and in collaboration with Pagliotti.
Okay, so we have brought up two names, Pagliotti, Borromeo, and other bishops. But before we go into any great detail about how their households worked and what happened within those households and what kind of administrative science they were developing, etc., it'll be good to have some kind of a background as to what is going on in the period. So who are these Tridentine bishops? Are they new bishops? I mean, we know that they're bishops from antiquity, right?
Right.
Going back to, I don't know, St. Augustine, Bishop of Hippo or something. Ambrose, Archbishop of Milan as Borromeo. So these go back, way back into antiquity. So what is new about these bishops? What is the Counter-Reformation doing that is transforming the persona of the bishop that makes these guys so significant for you?
Yeah. So as you know, of course, in the early modern period, if you want to do something new or make something reformed, one of the ways you go about doing that is by looking back to the past. And something that's really interesting about episcopacy in this period is that it is so old, right? That there's so many different models to choose from if you're going to go about saying, okay, we're going to reform this, you know, essentially bureaucratic arm of the Catholic Church.
So they are reforming by looking at the past, inventing stuff, right? Which is kind of also counterintuitive because the argument is that you look at the past in order to just confirm continuity and avoid change, right? You are going back to the roots of tradition in order to avoid change. And yet by doing that, they are changing. And so these bishops in the Counter-Reformation are looking back at the past, the behavior of other bishops, in order to kind of embrace that tradition. But when doing that, they are transforming the very concept of a bishop. So I would like to know what is the nature of that transformation? What is the Counter-Reformation doing to the institution of the bishop that makes it so central to the Counter-Reformation?
Yeah. So a couple of different things. So one thing just to note, and I'm sure we'll talk much more about this, is the Council of Trent and how much of the kind of onus of reform is placed upon bishops in those Tridentine decrees. And so we can talk about Trent in a little bit. But of course, just to point out that whenever you are hearkening back to the past, you know, you are sort of choosing certain paths over others. And so these post-Tridentine bishops like Borromeo and Pagliotti, they're very drawn to bishops from particular periods. So two of them you've already mentioned, Augustine, Ambrose. In the case of Bologna, there's also this slightly later Saint Petronio, who's very important. And when they go back to these, right, they're also kind of rejecting other elements of the past tradition. So of course, you know, episcopacy is this continuous tradition. And yet when one of the people who works with Pagliotti says, you know, in the last 100 years, no one outside of the city has seen a bishop. So that when Pagliotti's going on visitation and actually going in person to some of these rural towns in his diocese, he's doing something that hasn't been seen before. So they really place a lot of emphasis on residency as the thing to do, that the bishop is there in person to be seen.
Right. So we are so used to that idea of the bishop and his diocese. Unfortunately, there's no her diocese, but his diocese is kind of natural. But it appears like at the time, and this is one of the elements of the debate in Trent, the rooting the bishop in a locale and having the bishop live in a locale seems to be central to the entire thing. And the question is, why is that significant? Why a bishop living in Bologna or living in Milan or living whatever, there are 300 of them in Italy alone, why does it matter at all? How is that changing the nature of the state, as it were? Having all these administrators in cities and its hinterlands that are kind of in charge of rituals and in charge of the sacraments and in charge of overseeing priests and kind of disciplining priests and visiting all these parishes in the diocese once a year or once every 2 years and having the priests come to the city where the palace of the bishop is once a year to have synods. Why is that transforming the nature of the state?
Yeah, I think that there's, well, a couple things. You know, first, of course, there's nothing new under the sun, like Ecclesiastes said, such that, you know, how new is any of this really? Even in the 15th century in Italy, there are some bishops who take residency very seriously, and they themselves become important models for post-Tridentine bishop. So I wouldn't want to place maybe too much emphasis on the novelty here, but on the other hand, doing it at scale and, you know, largely across the Catholic world does have a serious impact. And you can see that impact perhaps best in just the boom of legislation that comes after Trent, where you have local legislation from local synods, from bishops who are on the ground. And, you know, this is something that Trent tries to put into place. And it really is a new phenomenon at this scale and in terms of what had happened for the 100 years prior.
Right. And here you have a very curious dynamic, it seems to me. On the one hand, you have local bishops that are now taking seriously their role in the cities and kind of overseeing all these parishes and all their own households, not allowed to being absent as they used to, by and large. That leads to this multiplication of legislation, canon law, or regulations, local regulations in dioceses that have been absent. And at the same time, you need a church that is uniform, right? That behaves in all these towns and in all these regions in similar ways, in which rituals are similar, in which legislation is similar. So how do you manage to create that uniformity when you have all these local bishops that now have the authority to create their own rulings everywhere? So how uniformity emerges out of these devolving authority to these local religious powerful figures that could have created all sorts of legislation and rulings of their own, leading to all sorts of conflict and difference, regional differences.
Absolutely. You know, Simon Ditchfield has taught us that, you know, the history of the Catholic Church in this period is a real tension between the local and the universal. You know, the fact that there's an attempt to make a kind of standardized universal liturgy, and yet at the same time, this desire to promote local cults and preserve particular liturgies, for example. So one of the ways in which this kind of tension between the desire for uniformity and also all of these local actors is resolved is the fact that a lot of the bishops that I looked at in Italy are all exchanging work with each other. So they are part of this broader network, and that not only do they write each other about their problems, everything from, you know, banditry in the diocese to, you know, local saints' cults, they also exchange printed legislation. So this synodal legislation that I mentioned earlier, it's, you know, getting circulated, getting imitated. And so as it turns out, they're not just copying the great bishops of the past. They're all copying each other.
All right. So that explains partly the uniformity or the seemingly uniformity of the rulings and local dioceses. I mean, there isn't an explosion of difference. Yeah, because it could lead to the Bologna liturgy and then the Paduan liturgy and then whatever the Napolitan liturgy, given the power of these individuals to enact legislation and to rule over their dioceses. What is the role of the papacy as well and these Roman Curia, these bureaucracy in Rome, what doing over these powerful local individuals that are being promoted to be powerful and local?
Yeah, that's a great question. And really a fundamental one for how we understand these Tridentine bishops. So I think, you know, in the past, we have really emphasized that the growing power of the papacy kind of eclipses the power of any of these local guys. And we've also, you know, people have pointed to the introduction of different congregations and the power that gets delegated to those congregations. But at the same time, I think we need to keep in mind that, you know, many of the people who sat on those congregations were themselves bishops. And so this story about, you know, how do we talk about, you know, the center, Rome, and the periphery, these dioceses, is really far more complicated than I think we've yet managed to convey.
So what is the papacy doing at the time? I mean, at the same time that it's promoting this institution through Trent, the so-called Counter-Reformation, this institution of a powerful local lord, religious local lord that oversees over all these wayward clergy that had concubines or whatever, and were not very well educated and were corrupt, et cetera, et cetera, as the explanation for the Reformation and Lutheran, Calvinism, and all that stuff. How the papacy manages to maintain control over these individuals at the same time that it needs this bureaucracy that is very powerful locally without losing control of the center.
So in the period I look at, you know, the kind of second half of the 16th century, there are two congregations that are really important. So the Congregation of the Council and the Congregation for Bishops. And as I mentioned, many of the bishops I study played an important role in the early years of these congregations. So we would, you know, not want to kind of pit these congregations against someone like Borromeo or Pagliotti. It is a sort of more collaborative work. And I think that in general, our understanding of the Counter-Reformation is undergoing a moment of revision where we are able to kind of appreciate the different ways in which it depends upon the work of many people and collaboration from above and below, the center and the periphery, in order to make up this, you know, behemoth that we call early modern Catholicism.
Right. Reading the writings you sent me, the original dissertation that is being revised for the book, one of the things that struck me about these discussions in Trent about bishops is who gets to elect them. And there seems to be, I don't know, a division and a consensus among the bishops that they should be, that they are elected by Christ, as it were. They are the heirs of the apostles, and it's no business of the papacy to kind of appoint them. But on the other hand, to have a church, a Catholic church, to oppose, I don't know, Lutheranism, or to oppose the Church of England, you need coordination, and you need a powerful papacy, a monarchy that coordinates among all these bishops. So the question remains: so what is the relationship between the Pope and these bishops? If they are elected by Christ, as it were, not by the Pope, what is the role of the papacy in the election of these bishops and in the oversight of these bishops and in controlling these powerful lords, in addition to the congregations, in addition to these communities of bishops themselves who are regulating themselves? I would like you to tell more as more about the papacy itself, more than the congregations.
Sure. Well, for starters, with the election of bishops, a lot more variation remains, you know, after Trent. I think the discussions at Trent almost outpace the actual effects, right? Because there are a lot of proponents at the council for kind of safeguarding the election of bishops in a way, or removing the power of monarchs or other kind of outside forces to appoint them. And yet, even after Trent, there's just a ton of variation in different parts of Europe and the rest of the world as for how bishops get appointed. So in terms of the papacy, you know, it's an interesting question. I think that the Bishop of Rome himself, right, the Pope himself in this period also starts adopting many of the strategies that the Tridentine bishops I looked at themselves are kind of in the process of creating. So if you look at Clement VIII, for example, Not only is he doing in-person visitations and thinking hard about art and other topics that these bishops were thinking about too, but he also sets new standards for the creation of bishops. So this is one way in which, kind of following up on Trent, there are higher standards for new bishops who are being selected, even if the kind of official appointment might still be pretty varied.
Right. So this is what is odd about the whole thing. There is this popular perception or this popular narrative. I grew up in that popular narrative. I come from a Catholic country in South America. And I think it's in the popular perception of most people in this country as well, that the Counter-Reformation, the response to the Reformation on the part of the Catholic Church, was greater centralization and greater power given to the papacy or to the Pope, to one individual. It's to the democratization of Lutheranism and to the democratization of Calvinism, the response is absolutism and monarchy on the part of Catholicism, the opposite, as it were. And therefore, it's tainted with that narrative of, you know, monarchy and centralization and absolutism and lack of democratic practices, etc. But what you are showing us here in the discussion we're having is that that is not really the case. That the heart of the atom of the Counter-Reformation is this decentralized structure of bishoprics. That through this counselor system or congregational system kind of get to reform everyday practices in local parishes, in local regions. And that out of this decentralization atomic structure, you create something called the papacy or Christendom, not the other way around. So how is it possible that we end up with this narrative of absolutism, lack of democratic practices, centralization versus Lutheran and Calvinist decentralization and democracy? Why do we have that narrative so weird?
Well, I think that the history of both the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation has largely been told, you know, by different confessional sides, for one thing. And also always, you know, the history we tell always reflects the politics of the present. So one thing that was really interesting for me doing this research was to see the kind of explosion in the scholarship in the 1960s and 70s on this topic that was inspired totally by Vatican II and kind of the demands that came out of that. But before we continue, I just want to also explain a bit more about this like collaborative Counter-Reformation that I'm talking a bit about. So really, like, I'm drawing there on the work of Karen Velez, who has compared the cult of the House of Laredo to the Star Wars franchise, you know, something in which the fans participate as much as any like studio executive, basically. And so that the kind of the devotees of Catholicism are really the ones who make this go global. And then also, if you look at the work of Hannah Marcus in Forbidden Knowledge, she shows exactly how physicians like Rossi, this guy from Ravenna, are collaborating with church censorship practices in order to make medical texts available in the Italian peninsula, sort of make them workable texts, basically. And I think all of these ways are just like really interesting and, as you say, you know, kind of counterintuitive ways to understand this because of the older narratives.
Right. It's a heavy older narrative that is still hovering over common sense and public opinion. I mean, so your scholarship is kind of, it has not percolated into the wider public sphere, it seems to me. And that there is kind of a something that makes it very difficult for people to perceive the early modern Catholicism in any other way besides powerful monarchical papacy, absolutist pope, an inquisition that cracks down on all any type of innovation, intellectual innovation, and of course the epitome of it all, Galileo. Galileo as the martyr of modernity. And so the antithesis of modernity becomes the Catholic Church in Rome and everywhere else. And yet, when one reads stuff like yours, one finds a very different set of things going on. I mean, these palaces of bishops and these households of bishops doing all sorts of things we associate with the modern knowledge. So I would like to turn a little to our conversation towards that aspect of the activity of the bishops. You mentioned at some point during our conversation that the bishops are introducing forms of administration, new forms of administration that we associate with modern practice of administration. What would those be? In what senses they are modern, and what are the novelties they are introducing in terms of administrative practices?
One of the things that we like to talk about as early modernists, kind of thinking about new government practices and things like that, are archives, right? And that paper is power in this period. Philip II, the paper king, the kind of new value of extremely detailed information that states are gathering in this same period. And from an ecclesiastic standpoint, all of this draws on older practices. Bishops in this period, the ones I study, actually do create new archives, but those archives often take over cathedral chapter archives that had been kept in the Middle Ages, and now become these diocesan archives. And many of them some of them are even located in the same places, basically at the heart of this complex that is the Bishop's Palace and the cathedral and other buildings that are connected to that.
So one form of modernity in administration would be that, the archive, and the centralization of paperwork and the keeping of paperwork in order to maintain the administration of cities and hinterlands in terms of rituals, sacraments, but also canon law. I mean, the state, at least in Catholic societies in the early modern period, is the church, not only the crown and the bureaucracy of the crown. The state I know and I work on, most of the activities having to do, let's say, with the slaves and manumission of the slaves and petitions of the slaves to be manumitted or be released or be set free in the New World happen at the level of cathedral chapters, in which slaves petition using the arguments of sacrament, that their families have been separated because they are married through Catholic ritual or Catholic sacrament. They petition not to be separated, and then they are not separated, and there is a prosecutor and there is lawyers, etc., that participate in these in meeting out justice and identifying who is right, who is wrong, all within the system of law set up by the church, not by the crown, not by high courts that are secular. So this is, in a way, the state just as much as any other secular element of the state, right?
Interesting, yeah.
So I wonder whether in Italy, if you have a cathedral chapter and all these high courts that have to do with the church, with all these lawyers and all these canon lawyers and all these individuals were trained to defend as lawyers and as prosecutors, etc., to administer the everyday life of individuals through marriage, through baptism, through, confession, etc., etc., all these, and also taxation, right? They have to contribute with the taxation or contributions to the church, that lead to a lot of legal conflict, a lot of issues that have to be resolved through courts in the church. I wonder whether Borromeo or Paleotti are not just charged with regulating issues of ritual, but regulating issues of state issues, literally.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, of course, this is the kind of jurisdictions of states and dioceses don't always map onto each other precisely, and that can lead to all kinds of issues. But I do think that, of course, like to some extent, like what the work on confessionalization has taught us is that it is really productive to think comparatively about what the state and the church are doing in this period.
Right. Well, in Spanish America, the state is the church.
Mm.
There is no separating. I mean, they are one and the same. And many viceroys are bishops, and many members of the high courts are canon lawyers, individuals who eventually become bishops. So you can be a member of high court and eventually become also a member of cathedral chapter. I mean, so there's a lot of lateral movement in these institutions, high courts of the church and high courts of the state, or I mean the civil or secular state, that is. So there is these overlapping. And also one of the things that is striking about the area that I study is this whole issue of the patronato real, namely a form of control of the church by the state that is almost Reformation-like or in Church of England-like, in which the state decides who is a bishop, and the bishop works for the king, doesn't work for the pope. And they are nominated by the monarch. They are not nominated by the papacy. The papacy, all it does is choose one of three names given by the crown. So these are bureaucracies that are literally financed and paid by the monarchy, that are controlled by the monarchy by and large. They are bureaucrats of the state, and where the papacy has very little saying in who gets nominated. The only saying is, well, by choosing one of three. But that is not, there is much of a choice ultimately. And so there is that element about the power of these individuals, the bishops, in places like the Indies or the Spanish monarchy, and I guess also the Portuguese monarchy, that both are global. So you have bishops in India, bishops in Macau and Asia, bishops in Southeast Asia, bishops in Angola, Congo, bishops in Brazil, bishops in all sorts of other places where this institution of the counter Reformation bishop, it has an added dimension of conquest and coloniality and possession and colonization that makes it a little different from Italy, the cases you have studied.
Yeah, thank you, Jorge. That's fascinating. I think, you know, sort of one way to draw out this difference is that in Milan, which of course is Spanish controlled at this point, Borromeo not only has jurisdictional disagreements with the crown, but also as a kind of show of who's in charge, he has the Spanish representative's chair removed from the inner sanctum of Milan's cathedral.
Well, that happens all the time in Spanish. Yeah. All the time. You have the bishop, an archbishop that removes the viceroy or excommunicates the governor on a daily matter basis. So one of the things that is striking about the 16th century, at least that I study, it is this constant conflict between ecclesiastical authorities and secular authorities, and the decision on the part of the secular of the church authorities most of the time to really take over, to control issues that were in the hands of secular authorities and take over the administration of justice by simply communicating royal secular authorities. And there you have it. You control the entire state apparatus that way by just removing the governor or removing the corregidor or removing the viceroy sometimes from the symbolic control of the state. And some of, I mean, one of the greatest rebellion in Mexico, 1624, I think, it was initiated by the clergy and bishops against the viceroy. And viceroy was removed, literally. The alter ego of the king was removed and had to step down. So you have a bishop, an archbishop, that staged the coup. And so Mexico City, the center of the Spanish Empire in the New World, throughout the 17th century, had this contest between viceroys and bishops, and it made it ungovernable. And there's actually a congregation of the church, of the papacy, that has to study this case of conflict between bishops and viceroys in Mexico. Such was the scandal. I don't know. I mean, it's just,
yeah, it's such here. There's such a rich story here about, with all this conflict. And jurisdiction is just the gift that keeps giving, I think, for historians. It's just so interesting and potentially illuminating, you know, 1,000 different illuminating micro histories in each of these conflicts.
Right. Well, the Spanish Empire is a very peculiar place. And in the Indies, even more. Yeah, given the factionalism. The immense factionalism. So in the case of Spanish America, the bishops are not, I mean, they are pitted against each other, like the bishops that you describe in northern Italy, where Milan and Bologna are working together with other places, Padua and so on and so forth. But in Mexico, at least in the 16th century that I studied, the bishops go at each other. And not only that, but the bishops are in great conflict with their cathedral chapters. There is no uniformity.
Oh, yeah.
So you find the same in
the cathedral chapter is always a potential source of conflict for the bishops. And one of the things that really struck me was also that the kind of records of the congregation of bishops, these different decisions on issues that plague bishops, or, you know, sort of particularly bad behavior by bishops in this period. Some of the copies of these cases were owned by cathedral canons, right? They want to know the bishop's playbook too, because they need it for these conflicts.
Right. So how to discipline the bishop. And so... Going back to the issue of modernity within these institutions that are using Renaissance philology in order to claim continuity while creating new things, you mentioned archives, but also in your dissertation, you point out to the centrality of communal praying. The pageantry, the things that we associate with, you know, non-modernity, these rituals of, you know, saint days, et cetera, as forms of modern social administration. That do you care telling us more about these aspects of the life of these bishops and their understanding of public praying and festivities of saints, et cetera, as a form of modern administration.
Okay. Well, let me know if I get off topic here. But yeah, one of the things that really struck me was the emphasis in both manuscript treatises, letters, all these things on public prayer as a kind of antidote, or at least counterweight, to what some of the literature has taught us to think about the kind of ways in which the Catholic devotional world in this period becomes very private, very much sort of determined by mental prayer, and the way in which the church absorbs this sort of previously somewhat subversive practice for its own. And so, you know, I was very much intrigued because these guys are putting on processions all the time, and they're also writing treatises about processions and thinking very explicitly about, you know, what is it that makes this public prayer and, you know, what needs to happen for this to be effective. And, you know, this is one of the most kind of efficacious tools in their arsenal for dealing with everything from, you know, plague to military threats. So it's something we also need to take seriously.
Oh, definitely. I mean, they are the kind of the forerunners of the use of, you know, these forms of communal mobilization in order to create identity, confessional identities, right?
Oh yeah, for sure.
And it's deliberate. I mean, it's not something that is just associated with, I mean, rituality that has to do that way, but it is a deliberate act in which, I mean, how do we use these forces of human nature in order to kind of strengthen bonds and, I don't know, forms of local identity through the cult of saints, et cetera, et cetera, that it goes beyond simply the theological and the sacred as forms of communal administration.
Mm-hmm. And even at the end of a synod, a procession was often considered part of that, right? So that it's not just this kind of administrative thing where you process a bunch of paperwork or something like that. It's also where all of the clergy or all of the bishops of a province and other clergy would come together and, you know, become the diocese, right? So yeah, as you say, there's like a communal aspect. And I think that, you know, we can't really separate the kind of devotional, administrative, scholarly work that goes into all of this.
Right, right. Well, it's literally the imagine communities through embodiment and commensality and being right next to each other and sweating. It's like football games, right?
Oh man, yeah.
Yeah, it's like the use of that type of practice to create community and to create communal identities.
Yeah, they're a big deal.
Yeah. So my original question is there is deliberate understanding that is going on. And in that sense, it's a manifestation of modern thought, a modern intellectual understanding of societies. It's not just a mindless practice as part of these tension and dialectic in the early modern church between traditional practices and new things that are emerging that we associate with, modern social thought or modern social sciences or modern science, period, astronomy, et cetera, et cetera. So in that sense, I would like to go back to the original question we had. I mean, the connection between these bishops, these counter-reformation bishops, and not only the modern archive, not only the management of societies, but also two things: modern history as, you know, a certain form of understanding archives and understanding the past and understanding the function of history, and the other, natural history collections, and so on and so forth, and how all these things come together in the palace of the bishop, but also in practices that are odd to us moderns, namely the understanding of relics, the understanding of sainthood. Who is a saint? How do you prove who is a saint and who is a fake, who is claiming sainthood? So the elucidation of credibility and trust.
Right.
Through forms of modern, what we think are modern epistemologies.
Right, right. I mean, you know, epistemology in this period is so drawn up with authority. And of course, as such, these bishops are sort of epistemological guardians, right? And Trent has tasked them with, you know, really making sure that relics are real, because there is this pressure from Protestantism, from things like Jean Calvin's treatise on relics, and you know, criticism that pokes fun at, like, oh, you know, those Catholics, they have so many splinters of wood to, you know, create a navy or something. So there is a lot of pressure to find ways to corroborate and kind of make believable different relics and things like that. So something that's been written about maybe even more than relics is the authentication or examination of saintly bodies in this period, which undergoes tons of change in both legislation and practices in the early modern period. And kind of fuzzy categories like incorruption get increasingly defined, or certain definitions become preferable to other definitions. And so you see this happening basically between, in a kind of collaboration between church officials and people with much more specialized knowledge, we might think of it. So, you know, anatomists, alchemists, physicians, artisans, artists, this kind of collaboration of different forms of knowledge ultimately becomes ecclesiastical knowledge.
That is fascinating, right? So instead of bringing up the supernatural and all these things that are being ridiculed by Calvinism and Lutheranism, they double down on them, but at the same time, they use science and they use all these new techniques in order to confirm that these are actual relics and actual saints.
Right. I think, you know, we've long known that, like, artisanal practices and expertise informs the new science, right? And you see it here as well, right? That there's this reliance and increased value put upon these different kinds of expertise, so that when Pagliotti has anatomists come in and look at, you know, jars of saints' blood and say, okay, these are legit, that, you know, there's an added value in doing that. And you can see even, like, you know, there's a value in doing that before even you get exact legislation that says, okay, you know, you need to bring in physicians and they need to, you know, look at this evidence. Or if someone has been miraculously cured by a prospective saint, then, like, you need to talk to the doctor of that person and make sure that, you know, a natural cure wasn't the real cause behind this.
So there's a lot of skepticism or promotion of skepticism of claims that need to be confirmed through some kind of alternative evidence that comes from all these practices. In the case of saints, absolutely. In the case of relics, right? Which, in a way, leads me to the last question, because we're running out of time, and is the emergence of forms of skepticism that are institutional. You said that the epistemology of the church was all about authority, yet there is authority, and there is authority, and there is authority. There are all these bishops that draw on different texts and different documentation in order to make alternative claims about this or the other, for instance, where their authority lies, whether they are just heirs of the apostles or they are appointed by the papacy. Mm-hmm. And you can draw on different texts of the Bible or different traditions within the church. And that multiplication of authority and interpretations of authority in places like Spanish America that I know best, led to something that we have associated with probabilism, this Jesuit way of thinking that if something can be justified through an authority, it's good enough. It doesn't matter if it's the best argument, But if it has an authority behind, that is good enough, and you need no more justification. It's fine. It can be done. But this began in the 16th century in Spanish America, multiplication of forms of sacraments, like, I mean, you know, matrimony among natives, or forms of baptism, or forms of confirmation, or forms of confession, or even the sacrament of the Eucharist, that is practiced differently in different places, given the access of resources, knowledge, et cetera, that lead to forms of relativism, of probabilism, as it were, that we associate with modernity, ultimately, with skepticism and approximation to the truth, not the truth. There is not truth. There is always approximation to something we call the truth, that, in a way, we have come to associate with the new science of Newton and Bacon, etc. So in which ways is that expressed in places like Bologna or Milan?
Yeah, I think that they fall back on tradition a lot. If they don't have, you know, exactly the right text that they would need, you know, they are hesitant to contradict evidence of a continuous tradition of worship in the case of a relic. And one interesting example I wanted to bring up too is that Pagliacci was kind of consulted and asked about how to paint a historically accurate assumption of the Virgin Mary. And, you know, shouldn't there only be 11 apostles depicted because James was dead at the time? And Pagliacci says, you know, okay, when there is no authentic text, it's bad to alter anything. We don't want to deviate from the ancient custom of the Holy Church. And so I think this kind of falling back on tradition when there isn't anything better, or when the evidence you have doesn't quite line up, that's sort of their safety net.
Well, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you very much, Madeline, for this conversation. We have reached our hour of podcast, but you are all invited next Tuesday, November 22nd. Monday, November 22nd at noon, for a webinar, Zoom webinar, on the work of Madeline, and we'll have very distinguished historians of science and historians of early modern knowledge among the panelists. So again, we invite you to come and attend this conversation on Monday at noon. And Madeline, thank you again for sharing with us all your knowledge and your expertise. Thank you.
Thank you, Jorge. It's been a pleasure to be here.